Hello, everyone. This is Ron Stockton once again. This is the second of three interviews on this amazing archive project. This time we'll be interviewing Mr. Adel Viseso, the creator of this archive. We'll focus on his family and upon himself. The third interview will focus on the archive. Mr. Viseso, are you ready to start?
I am, sir. Good morning to you.
Good morning. So why don't we start? Tell me about yourself. Where were you born? What is your occupation, your education?
Thank you, sir. I was born in El Bira, Palestine, also known as Bira. It's a suburb of Ramallah. And my occupation is I'm an entrepreneur businessman. My disciplines range from mathematics, finance, and technology. And for the past 4 decades, I have launched 3 particular companies from ground up. Two of them going public as CEO of those companies. Mm-hmm. Today, I'm semi-retired and focusing on my son and this project.
Oh, okay. Very good. Where were you educated?
I attended 2 universities. I went to Princeton for mathematics, and I finished at NYU with my businesses, as far as like business.
Tell me about your family history. I know your grandfather was an iconic figure, but what about the family before him?
That's a great question. My family has a depth of existence and a lineage in the Palestine and the Arab world in general. We go back to the heritage of Levantines, and we can be traced back for many centuries to go back beyond the Byzantine Empire. From the Levantines settling in Egypt and moving to Palestine in the 8th century in Jerusalem and Haifa. So there's a big lineage that goes back to the original name of Kayali. And about 8 centuries back in Jerusalem, the name Viseso emerged from that lineage. And we can go in depth of what that name means and how it happened.
Okay, tell me about that. That I've never encountered that name before. So tell me about that name.
The name Viseso comes from Bissa, which means cat. And how that derived was, for centuries, my family has specialized in farming, agriculture, and mills. And this is where the name came from. The villagers and all of the people that purchased commodities from my family to the mills. My great, great, great grandfather, going back 8 centuries to Muhammad, was the first one to carry that name. And that name derived from the mills because he housed many, many cats, over 100 cats, to take care of the rodent problems in the mills and to do that. So the villagers and all of the people that purchased stuff from him referred to him as the father of cats, Abu Bissa, which then became the family name, Viseso, coming from that historical transformation from Kayali to Abu Bissa, which is the father of cats.
Wonderful story. Cats are unique. I know the first time I went to the Middle East, I noticed these cats. Cats were everywhere, you know, and they were wild cats. They were feral cats. They'd never been petted or anything. So they were very different from the little kitties that I, you know, from my house.
Yes, sir.
How did your family acquire a very large number of Beersheba area?
In the Beersheba area, like I indicated in the past, you know, they settled in Jerusalem and Haifa, mostly in Jerusalem, where my grandfather was born. Like I said, for centuries, over 12 centuries, they owned and operated the largest farming and mills in the Middle East and in as far as the Palestinian coast goes. So they acquired a lot of the property through inheritance and brought downs and so on through the family. My grandfather in Beersheba, all of the properties in Beersheba was acquired by purchase with my grandfather's success as he migrated from Jerusalem to Beersheba in the early 1900s.
I won basically from the owners.
Yes, here's how it started. He, you know, his one of his great uncles, who he had a tremendous relationship, Ursay Bisseso, lived in Beersheba. They had a great relationship together. And at that time, he visited and was looking to partner up with him on certain projects to go ahead and also look at the desert oases and be able to do the same things that he did in Jerusalem with farming and mills and so on. After a few back and forth travels over the years in the late 1800s, early 1900s, he got to know the government of Turkey and the Ottoman Empire very well in that region. And in the early 1900s, 1905, he was invited by the Ottoman Empire to come in and to head off a agriculture and civilization type of project, civil engineering, to kind of expand the culture there from the businesses of agriculture, farming, and so on. In 1906, he had one reference that he wanted, and which is to be an independent, and the Ottoman Empire and the Turks granted him that and gave him the first purchase that he made in 1906. He purchased over 4,400 dirhams, which is what an acre is, or roughly an acre is, back in those days, from the Ottoman Empire to start the first farm. So that's how he started in his purchase and endeavors in Beersheba. The first purchase agreement made was with the government ruling at that time, which was the Ottoman Empire, and was given and fortitude with their ruling to go ahead and expand his purchasing power and expand the agricultural power and industrialize. He had a vision to industrialize that whole area. And over the next 20 years from there, he acquired a massive amount of properties. He did that by getting to know all of the tribal leaders in the areas, the sheikhs, the political leaders, and cultivated a organization that allowed him to expand that vision for industrializing. Purchased over hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dirhams over the next 30 years from that first date of 26.
Do you have any idea of the total amount of property that he owned in terms of the size, or is that really hard to estimate?
It's difficult to estimate because of the documents that were left and which were derived this archive from was only a fraction of what he really owned. And those are the ones that he was able to carry with him as original documents. But those indicate well over 20,000 dirhams of property. It was estimated by the family throughout the years, and especially the descriptions with my father, that he owned well over one third of all of Southern Palestine.
So your family started with a base farther north in Jerusalem and Haifa, and then they moved south.
That is correct. The family from Mahrus, which is my great grandfather, my grandfather, Mr. Mahrus, he's the one that migrated my lineage of the family through my father. My father was born in Beersheba, and so was the rest of his the kids that were born there. The family still lives out throughout the Middle East, but really the heritage and everything started in Jerusalem and Haifa Until the early 1900s.
You know, what you describe is very common with empires who have a big chunk, a zone of their land that's underdeveloped, and they want to develop it. So they'll find someone who is energetic and creative and work with that person. And so it's not surprising that your family was favored and became wealthy, because they were performing a very vital service for the empire, that they wanted that land developed. They didn't want it just sitting there, being used for casual grazing or whatever it might be.
That is correct. If we take a step back, one of the reasons they identified and really wanted Mr. Mahrouz to take this endeavor is he launched the commodities import to a lot of this wheat and grain, and commissioned the shipping through the entire European belt line through their mills in Jerusalem. This was his brainchild, and he started that whole entire logistics from Jerusalem throughout Europe with grain and wheat and so on. So when that's when he exploded with success, is that he cultivated wealth that allowed him to have the finances when he went to Beersheba to really go after a lot of this growth and vision to industrialize that whole region.
He was involved in a lot more than just agriculture, though, wasn't he? He had a whole range of enterprises.
That is correct. He in Beersheba, he started and launched mining companies. He was working on purchasing and further developing the railroads, education, manufacturing, and medical. He wanted to completely industrialize and make Beersheba a port for the entire Middle Eastern side to go ahead and continue and do the exact same thing he started in Jerusalem with the logistics and the import of a lot of the agriculture that was being developed there to further enhance the living conditions of all of the people there. He was the only thing bigger than his mind and his vision was his love for the Palestinian people and what he really wanted to do with that region and expand it. He was the first to build and dig a well and made it easy access for all of the villagers and the Bedouins to have access to the water, as well as purchasing historical reservoirs and re-engineering that so that he gave access to all of the farmers for growth, as well as the land that he was developing for farming as well.
Now, we're not talking today about the archive. We'll do that the next conversation. But yes. I know that for those of us from the American Midwest, the idea of a well is a very distinctive concept. We know what a well is, but this concept of a well, it's totally different, isn't it? I know you have a photo of it, but could you tell us what that well was like?
Well, in quest of making sure that water was accessible to the villagers and the Bedouins, because in the desert, water doesn't come easy. So he took his skill sets and put them to work for the better of the people by drilling a well, which still exists in the middle of the town. And at the time, it was known as El Beersheba. And that was the historical name of the colonial name now being Beersheba. And along with that, he just wanted to make sure that not only did he prosper, but also the people that originated and the indigenous people of Beersheba prosperous by giving his technique and skills and his finance and put them to work for those people without any charge. Mm-hmm. He wanted to give back. Is just a couple on that. His uncle and himself also built the first mosque in Beersheba to allow all kinds to worship at their speed with no judgment and no invitation needed.
Now, that land, that well was also used for irrigation, wasn't it?
That is correct. He continued to allow he introduced state-of-the-art equipment and irrigation technologies from all over the world, and brought them to Beersheba. Equipment, irrigation systems, techniques of wells, how to run, how to be able to run pipes and be able to transport that water directly into those farms. He introduced that whole entire technology to that region and implemented it fairly. Just to give you an example, over 150,000 dunams of farming was developed by Mr. Mahrouz and the new technology of irrigation. It really flourished in the wheat and grain farming business over the 30 years that he endeavored in that area.
I've told you before, I think some scholar is going to grab this archive and write a very good book on what Palestine was like before 1948. This was a thriving area, wasn't it?
It sure was. And the mistake that the history has made, and history is written two ways, fiction and fact, and sometimes it takes time to fix the difference between fiction and fact. We speak to the facts here by having you, like I said, we'll go through the documents and these original documents in the next interview. But just to give a full understanding that the pride of having the different makeups of Palestinians, from the Bedouins to the villagers, to also the educated and entrepreneurs and visionaries of that time, history does not describe the entrepreneurs and the business and the educated of the Palestinians. They only describe the indigenous Bedouins and tribes that had no organization, didn't really own the land, had no tax receipts to any of that land. And what these documents and Mr. Mahrouz will change history by presenting original documents that show the facts that there were contracts, there were agreements, there was tax being paid. And he navigated his way through all of the political makeup and through the Ottoman Empire to the British, to the Jordanians, and finally to the Israel, which he paid taxes to all of those people on the properties and businesses that he owned. And that's what this will show the world. And like you said, scholars and historians and students and human rights and everybody that's interested in this region and what really happened is going to get an eye opener of these facts from these original documents.
Mm-hmm. I think you told me that some of your family, maybe your father even, had been educated in Britain. Is this correct?
That is correct. He was born in 1924. And as we know from history, that the British had ruled. So they made an educated guess, for lack of better terms, to educate him at Cambridge in the business and finance world, because he was the heir apparent to my grandfather. Educated in his late teens into his early 20s. But if you look at the time factor, by the time he finished school and rejoined his father, the war of 1948 had broken out. And so well-educated in those terms, educated in the family business from, when you're knee high, that's how it worked in those days.
Yes.
And so that's how they planned it out. They really, of a lot of the stories and the dialogue that I've had with my father about my grandfather and his relationships, the assurance that the British would secure that part of Palestine and it would never be part of anything that happened, that obviously we all know. He had assurance all the way to the top political heads of the British Empire that this would not happen, and it did. And so here we are 70 years later, still trying to figure out what happened.
Yeah, exactly. I have a lot of good friends who are British, so I want to say very nice things about the British because I like every one of them. But there's an old saying that the sun never sets on the British Empire because you can't trust an Englishman after dark.
Yeah, you know, facts is all that I want to deal with. You know, I don't have a political agenda. I don't have any kind of agenda except to set the record straight and honor Mr. Mahrouz and the family for what they were and who they were to the people of Palestine and the country of Palestine.
Immediately, that's one of the things that really drew me to this project. It's not a political project. You're just putting data into the historical record that has been missing up until the current time, and that fills in a lot.
Yes, fills in the gaps, and like we discussed, that history is written from two things: fiction and facts. And we've read enough fiction, and it's time to read some facts.
Mm-hmm. So, tell me what happened in 1948.
In 1948, as the stories through my father have been passed down to me, it was quite a horrific transformation from one ruling to the other. The understanding was it was a temporary, escape. It was a temporary movement from a lot of the villagers and a lot of the state owners, that they would get their land back. They would get this. It was a temporary move just to settle things down and then be able to really address things from a political perspective that the British Empire had set forth. And so a lot of the villagers were taken over by force. A lot of the burning, a lot of the war machine that's never been described, as the horror that the Palestinians endured during that time. My grandfather, Mr. Mahrouz, had the fortitude to not just give in to all of that. If nothing else, when he left his estate by force, he cultivated these documents, and some of the documents that he didn't get them all, but he did take these documents with him just in case that was not. And they started to see the writing on the wall that was not going to be the case at even early stages, that this was just a ploy to move them out peacefully without destruction, and then take over properties and lands that were not part of the whatever that is they put together in a partition or split the state. That part of the world, Beersheba, was a historical place for Palestine, and they never negotiated any part of that to be part of the Israeli state. And so they had that to lean on from the British government. And my grandfather was very attached, because he was probably the wealthiest guy in that area and the most influential business and financier guy in that area, and was very tied to all of that movement. And he was not a typical human being. Had he had any kind of thought that this was not the fact, he would have been gone a long time ago. He mm-hmm. wouldn't have left everything there to be despaired like it was. And see, the stories that have been passed on from my father was just that, the horrific takeover, the complete dismantling of a indigenous race, and the eraser was already, been shown that this is what the Zionists wanted to do, and this is what Israeli wanted to do. And the British just kind of left everything in their hands and packed up and left, and didn't follow through with making sure that both humanitarian logistics and everything else that went with it was what everybody negotiated that this would be. The Palestinians were not at war with anybody. And this is what they ended up with, the short end of the stick, because nobody cared.
Under different circumstances, a conquering army would make an alliance reach out to someone like your grandfather and try to work with that person rather than try to obliterate or erase them, as you said. And so this was a very unique conquest, not at all like any other conquest, like the typical conquest.
That is correct. And from the understanding from the heads of the government that was in Beersheba, and it was a portal at that point, and it became a port for a lot of the stuff based on what my grandfather had built and expanded. And there, like I said, there is no way that this was not the way it was going to be handled. It was going to be negotiated. It was going to be fair settlements. It was going to be, you know, done with a humanitarian approach, because nobody was at war with anybody. The Palestinian people didn't have an army. They weren't at war with the Israelis. They just happened to be in a place that the world decided that this is where Israel started, and this is where they were going to give them back land without really knowing their history of how and what. Then everybody derived from the Levitin. And so is my family, and a lot of other families in the Palestinian were there before the Israelites. And so it doesn't make much sense. Then it didn't make much sense when they did it. And the biggest mistake made was by the British to be able to make these promises and make these securities to some of the most prominent people in that region, sheikhs, leaders of tribes, business and entrepreneur guys like my grandfather, that this would be an easy transition. Yes, it's not going to be likable by anybody, but it was going to be definitely fair and negotiated, not with destruction and bloodshed and to erase an entire race from its existence.
We just, there's what's called counterfactual history, like in which historians say, what if it had worked out this way? How would the world be different? And you just think of how the world could be different if that conquest had occurred under different circumstances, with a different approach, with a different strategy. Who knows?
God only knows.
Yeah, exactly. How did your grandfather get those documents out? Did he just put them in a box and carry them, or what did he do? Do you know?
No, my father said that he actually divided the documents among the kids and put them in his shirts in their bodies, in their shirts, and carried them out because there was no bag that was left unopened. There was nothing that you could carry with you that was not confiscated. The picture was painted by gunpoint. Did they lead my grandfather out of his estate? So he had the fortitude to be able to import these and get them out of there by putting them under the shirts, and you know, nobody frisked down the kids. So that's how we got them out.
That's amazing. He used the children.
He used the children.
Isn't that amazing?
Smart man.
Yeah. Now, you told me your grandfather suffered a serious blow during that time.
He did. When the 48 war had happened, and the scramble of all of this, for the next 20 years, 30 years, both my grandfather and my father attempted this. And in the late 40s, early 50s, they would gather in towns. This is how, you know, these meetings took place. And my grandfather was a very well-known, very prominent man. And he was attacked by God knows what. And he was struck in the head with a hammer and never recovered from that. Always suffered seizures, somewhat his faculties, but not all of them. He continued to work through my father, who was in his mid-20s at that point, but was ridden with these injuries. And, from my family perspective, You know, there's always been this bullseye, so to speak, on who they are and who they were, and never wanted to be heard of. And you could tell a lot of the, even the witnesses and the people that lived in that region, that my grandfather had witnessed these contracts and these agreements, appear in the history books, but for some reason he doesn't. And so they would left a lot for us to figure out why, when, and how, but there was always that stigma about the last name and the, and the target that it had on its back. And been many of them assassinated throughout the years, for one particular reason or another, and which left the family extremely paranoid and scared for some of their lives, especially knowing my father, knowing he had these documents. He was extremely paranoid and scared for himself and his children.
Where was he living at that time?
They moved, you know, they moved from Beersheba into back to Haifa and Jerusalem, and then eventually moved out into the Kuwait and Jordan, which they spent from the 51 all the way up until the late 50s before they moved to Ramallah and settled there. My grandfather and grandmother had lived with my father from the time of 48 all the way until he passed in 68.
But so you knew your grandfather, didn't you?
I was 5 years old when he passed away. I was born in 62. Yeah. And after the war in 67, he lost all will to live. He was heartbroken at that point, as everyone else in that region. I was born into a broken, in war-torn country with a lot of uncertainties. And when the 67 war broke out, I was 5 years old, and that's when my grandfather passed. I have memories and faded memories of him, but I only know him as a man and a giant through my father, through the stories. Mm-hmm. And now as I researched these documents and built this archive, I grew a tremendous respect and pride and got to know my grandfather in ways I've never have.
Amazing. How did you come to be in possession of these documents? I'm guessing you're like the inheritor of the family tradition or something.
You could say that. My father, always growing up, always referred to me and tell me I reminded him a lot of Mr. Mahrouz. And since, the beginning, he recognized, and I had a really good relationship on and off with my father, but the end of the years between him and I were magical and extremely close. And he entrusted me with these and passed them on to me with exactly what Mahrouz wanted with these. And so he entrusted me with this prior to his passing in the early 2000s to do the right thing with them. The time will come, just to never let the world ever forget, and to always remember my dying grandfather's wish for all of this, is that he wanted everything, if it ever comes to fruition or any reparation or anything, to go back to the citizens of Palestine and to help those that are in need more than anything. He was never a greedy person and wanted to make sure that whoever was entrusted with this, with these documents, would carry on that wish. And so I was handed this, and along with the descriptions and the wishes of my ancestors and my father and my grandfather, and the timing of this was never right for me because of my endeavors and my businesses and just the makeup of the stigma of what was happening with the region, with the Arabs and so on. Until this time. But this is how I came to possess these documents. They were entrusted in my hands to carry on a wish.
It's wonderful to think of how these documents survived. many historical documents are just lost. They're gone. And with them are gone the history and everything, you know. I've studied my own family history. Eastern Tennessee was once an independent state called Franklin. And it had a parliament or legislature, whatever you would call it. And there was a man who was ultimately it got folded into what is today Tennessee. So the man who was in charge of the documents put them all and kept them very preciously. And his son kept them preciously. But in time, they became the possession of his granddaughter. And she and her new husband were moving from East Tennessee, someplace west where there was more land. And he just wasn't interested in any of this. So he burned the barrel.
God.
I mean, you just think of somebody coming along who doesn't appreciate what these documents are. They could be lost. You've been able to save them. So you've done not only a service to your family, but a service to history and a service to the Palestinian people by preserving an existence and a story that would otherwise be lost. And it's not just existing in a story. It's existing in official documents, which historians really like, because you can read exactly what is there. And we'll talk about that in our next conversation, what is actually there. Let me ask you something personal. You're born in Beerzeit. You're now living in the United States. You're obviously a Palestinian, but you're also an American. So tell me about how your understanding of what it means to be a Palestinian has evolved over time. What does this mean to you? You know, I tell my students that this is an amazing country because you can actually become an American, but you have to pay a price for that. The country will gobble you up and spit out something totally new and different. And much of what you are before is lost unless you preserve it. So I was always telling my students, Amin will tell you this, I was always telling my students who were immigrants, because I have a grandmother who's an immigrant, and I say, if you don't write it down, it's lost. You have to write it down. But anyway, tell me what it means to you to be a Palestinian in a country that, to be honest, is not very friendly to the Palestinians.
Oh, well, you hit it on the nose. And when we finally made it to America in the early 70s, 1972, I was 10 years old. And the horror that I incurred in this country was a lot to bear as a young 10-year-old. Being ridiculed, being pointed out, being bullied just for who I was. And that in itself hurt a lot, made me not want to be a Palestinian, made me not want to be an Arab, made me feel really unwanted and unneeded in a strange land. And here's a 10-year-old boy trying to go to school, not understanding the language, and then being judged for that. It could have turned two ways, and it did at the beginning. I became very angry. I became hard to handle. But I also became galvanized in making sure that I rose above that, because I knew what kind of intelligence I had even back then. And I wasn't going to be painted into a picture that somebody else was going to paint me in. So I started to excel. The first 3 years until I was 13, I kind of lived hell here on earth. That's what it felt like. Mm-hmm. Unwanted, hated, spit at, bullied, judged. And, you know, no fault to my family. My father was trying to survive. You know, my whole family was trying to survive in this new world. A very well-educated man who couldn't get a job, had ended up working in a grocery store. You know, a lot of these things weigh heavy. especially to a man that was the heir apparent to everything that we described, pre-1948, to be sweeping floors at a grocery store to keep his family, alive here in America. So that's the beginning of it. And, as I turned 13, I became an exceptional athlete in the wrestling side of the world. So I started to rise in that. And then I was a honor student in mathematics. English was a little rough because I still didn't get the language pretty well, but I excelled in math. And so there I became a little bit more, my confidence levels and as a leader became at a young age galvanized in me that I will not allow the world to paint me into a picture that I'm not. And that's where it all started for me. So, and years have passed by, we're still the same, hiding in the shadows of being a Palestinian or Arab man, because you wouldn't be recognized as a talented or anything of that nature because you were pigeonholed. You know, racism was I felt it just like the Indians did back in the day. And that's kind of how I felt. The only people I could really relate to was the indigenous Indians and how they lived in a country that was theirs, and then how they were treated in that country, even years and years and years later. Through the studies, I gravitated to that. And it took a long, long time, Professor, for me to even, recognize or be proud to come from Palestine, because everything was written against it in America. And it felt like America was just a big brother to Israel. And it was hard to have doors open. I can't even begin to tell you how many doors were slammed, not based on the talent, not based on skill sets, just based on who you are and where you came from. And so, there came a time where I changed the character in my own book and didn't even identify as a Palestinian or an Arab until the later years, after gaining many, many successes and doors not being slammed in my face, because I no longer identified as that. I identified as an American, and things changed. Mm-hmm. And now I'm coming full circle, and we will talk about the real ignite of me taking on this project in my later years and how that really happened. Mm-hmm. And we will go in depth in that as you know, when you are ready to go into those. Mm-hmm. But that's really the story of how it all, what difference of being a Palestinian man and an American man. I was a Palestinian child that he died at about 13, reborn at around 50.
Interesting way to put it. I would just, it's getting close to the anniversary of September 11th, and I just saw that to a book, I said, does anyone have any memories of what happened that day? Well, many of my former students were, they were third graders at the time or whatever. They were very young, but others were older, and they started telling these stories. And of course, the Arab kids had distinctive stories because those people were Arabs, and they thought, okay, am I going to be blamed for this? And some were blamed for it, and some were not blamed for it, but all of them had a reaction. Some were refugees from war. One person said, I saw had fled a war in Iraq, and now suddenly he felt once again, all the things that he felt before. And I think, this has been for me an amazing thing. I grew up in a Wonder Bread culture, and so for me, being in Dearborn, where I've over my career had so many Arab students who have talked to me and discussed their family stories and whatever, it's been amazing to me to see all of these different things, how people have evolved, how they've reacted, the experiences they've had. So I'm really pleased at how eloquently you've just described your own evolution as a going from a young boy who's very when the Lebanese civil war started, Dearborn got inundated. We had an old Arab population of people who were immigrants, and they came here looking for jobs. And those people sort of approach things in a very positive way. You know, one of my neighbors said, I told my kids I didn't change countries and move 7,000 miles so you could goof off after school. So I want you home, and I want you working on your homework within 30 minutes of when the school is out, and I know when it's out. So, you know, that's one approach. But in the 80s, when my kids were in the local high school, they suddenly got overwhelmed with very large numbers of refugees. And those kids had adjustment problems, you know. And one of my students said to me, I've seen more dead bodies than we'll ever know. I mean, that's an experience you never get over. And so I want to thank you for explaining so eloquently your own process of going through this adjustment period. So do you have any final thoughts? We've been going on, I think, for close to an hour. Do you have any final thoughts you would like to add?
My final thoughts would be this. It's a very, very, really strong journey I have traveled. It's one that has so many emotional roller coasters for me. As a young child, for 3 years living in refugee camps and seeing the destruction of war and seeing the loss of hope in people's faces, that it's really a faded, buried memory for me. To come full circle and have my own kids and seeing the prospects of my own kids and how I really sunk my teeth into this and really hit home and hit me in the spirit, my soul, and my heart, is I have an 18-year-old son, and 3 years ago, he came to me because he befriended a Palestinian kid in school that needed help with math. And he's exceptional in math and started to tutor this young man named Yusuf and became really close to him. To come home to me and ask me, aren't we Palestinian too? And why don't I know anything about where I came from? Who and what, where, and what that culture is all about. It hit home with me. And that's when I decided my son, his kids, my grandkids, and anybody else attached to me will never forget what and where we came from. And I started to go down the path of building this archive and building this history and the story and to stay to the facts so that he would have the same pride and that glimmer in his eyes that he had in helping this Palestinian and in understanding that he is Palestinian and what that means moving forward. And so this is the real, if I leave you with my last thoughts, is this is what this project means to me. It is not political. It's not religious. It has no agenda except to address the fact and educate young Arabs, Palestinians, and all races alike with the facts and educate them a little bit more about the beauty and the culture of the Palestinian people and who they were, the pride of the Bedouins, the pride of the tribes, and the pride of the educated. And they're all the same. Not one is less than the other. And they are the heart of the Arab world and can never be forgotten. And if I can add one brick into that, that would be a great legacy for me to leave.
That's a wonderful statement. So thank you very much. And we'll be back again to talk about the archive and what those documents tell us.
I look forward to it, Professor. Thanks a lot. Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye.